Megillat Esther is itself a very bizarre text within the Tanakh. I'd like to start off with the Tosefta, which I'm sure everybody here is very familiar with, in which we have four different opinions about how much of the Megillah we're chayiv to read on Purim. We, of course, pass an Akrab Meir that we have to read from the beginning, but there is the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda, we read from Ish Yehudi, the opinion of Rabbi Yossi, to read from Achar Dvarim Ha'el, the beginning of the story of Haman, and of course, famously, the opinion of Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, which is omitted from the Mishnah, but mentioned, the Gemara quotes at Tosefta, to read from Balayla Hahu, halfway through the Megillah. To our delight, as students of Tanakh and to the chagrin of children world over, we pass it like Rav Meir, kids hate the first two prakim. They don't get to make any noise. And by the way, did you know that the first two prakim combined have 40 million psukim in them? Ask any five-year-old. It goes on forever. This year we're a little bit in better shape, but most years it's also two very hungry prakim. But I'd like to ask a different question regardless of the opinion. Because even Rav Shimon Bar Yochai agrees that you need to read from a full Megillah. So I'm asking more of a canonization question. Why is the entire Megillah, as we have it, part of Tanakh? Why the story of the Megillah is in Tanakh is a good question in and of itself, but as a result of the consequences, we could certainly understand. I'd like to add one other piece which will raise the justification for the inclusion of Megillah and Tanakh and raise the question I'm going to present in a minute even higher. Chazal in Masechet Megillah, Daf Yudal, in the famous Sugya, in the middle of the Sugya of the Agada of Purim, mentioned on the Pasuk, on Atayim Tzofim, that there were Kiflayim Kiyotze Mitzrayim, Nevim be Israel, millions of Nevim. So why is it that our Tanakh is relatively so small? Compact edition. And the answer is Nevuah Shehutzur Chaladorot Nichtava. Only those Nevuot which had permanent, perennial, eternal impact were canonized. And there are all sorts of other Nevuot. And by the way, many of them are alluded to in Tanakh. Mentions of other Sfarim that we don't have. And Megillat Esther indeed serves that function proudly. There are many models in Tanakh of particular stories, of particular heroes, that have been adopted over the generations by people in similar circumstances as guides. An example of that is a passage in the Midrash, which the Ramban develops beautifully in Parsha Vayishlach, that the meeting between Yaakov and Esav became a model for all interactions between the Jewish people and their opponents, chiefly when the opponent was Rome and later on the Vatican. And indeed, there's a story that Rabbi Yehuda Anasi used to read Parsha Vayishlach every time he had to go to Rome or to meet with the Roman proconsul. And one time he didn't, and as a result, he had a tragedy happen. On an even sadder tone, but one which is very, very real. Fathers who took their sons down to the Rhine and slaughtered them before the crusaders would come and take them saw themselves as latter-day Avrahams. And indeed, the development of many of the late Midrashim on the Akedah developed around the Crusades. The significance of the Akedah, the people reliving it. That's something which, of course, doesn't start with the Crusades. The famous story of the woman and her seven children, in which in one version she's called Chana, in other versions she's Ha'ishav, Shiva Baneha, that when the seventh son is about to be killed, what does she tell him to do? Go to Avram Avinu and tell him, you were willing to sacrifice one son, I sacrificed seven. So she saw herself as a continuation, or modeling herself, or perhaps being inspired by the model of Abraham. And indeed, through of roughly two millennia of challenging relationships with foreign or governments that to us were foreign, but under whose rule we lived, Megillat Esther often served as both inspiration and something of a playbook. Minyone Diyoma, as a bit of a playbook for how we should negotiate. I heard that there's something going on tonight in New Orleans. Is this true? I'll be on a plane, I don't know. Where is it? So you see how much I know. We don't have a football team in L.A. I don't know about it. And so Megillat Esther has tremendous significance, not only in the story itself, but the impact and the lessons and the directions and the advice that it gave for Jews, which continued through the modern era. But that raises the question I'm going to pose to an even greater level. Because if you read the first two prakim of the Megillah, you will find that there is very little there that advances the plot, and very little there that helps us with any of this eternal instruction. Just to summarize, but if you have the text of the Megillah in front of you, it'll help. Because we're going to look at the psukim later on. The first perek is essentially a description of a lavish party, followed by a lavish second party, at which at the very, very climax of the party, catastrophe strikes, a catastrophe which bothers us not at all. And that is the summoning of Vashti. We'll look at the details in a few minutes. And then there is a tremendous uproar within the inner circles of the king, of the emperor, of how to deal with Vashti. And finally at the end, and it's an interesting thing, we get lots of details about the advice and the counsel and the decision being made. Of course, at the end, we have no idea what happened to Vashti. Vashti's future, I'm sure she's probably dead. But as far as within the context of the story, we don't know where she is. So there's a lot of back and forth about what to do and why to do and how to inform, but her actual fate is left as a mystery. But that entire perek is not only unnecessary for the plot, it could have been summed up in about two psukim if you were going to be somewhat verbose. Because as far as we're concerned, the only problem is the king needs a queen. And that's how Esther gets into the position. The second perek is not only somewhat superfluous, meaning there's a couple of psukim that are needed. We need to find out that Mordechai exists, maybe. At least we don't really need his lineage, but we need to know that Mordechai exists. But it's not only superfluous to hear about the primping and the fragrances and the oils and the pillators and who knows what, but frankly, I'm offended by it. Don't let me leave the room till I clear that up. But on a knee-jerk reaction, as a student of Tanakh, used to reading the most noble, the most beautiful, sometimes scathing, but nonetheless significant to profound statements, to read a whole chapter about these young girls being prepared for the night with the king and their night with the king and where they go afterward. Let's keep it moving. What's it there for? And indeed, the whole first two prakim, up until the very end of Perek Bet, please take a look at the end of Perek Bet, Sukim Chafalot to Chav Gimel, are significant for our story. The story of the plot of Bigtan Vateresh to kill Ahasuerus, more significantly, Mordechai discovering this plot, and Mordechai informing Esther, and then Esther telling the king, B'Shem Mordechai, that is critical for our plot. Understood. But everything till there, we could have done in a couple of psukim. Esther is the queen, and she doesn't tell anybody that she's Jewish or related to Mordechai. That's pretty much all we need. And the kids don't have to be upset, and we don't have to be so hungry, and Bali Kriya can learn two less prakim, and Sofrim will have an extra couple days off. So obviously a question like this is not answered by saying, yeah. So that's by saying, tzricha. And what's the tzrichuta? So the answer really cuts to our understanding what happens in the main plot of the Megillah. And it's important to note that what we're going to do this morning over the course of the next 40 minutes or so in looking at the Megillah is bata ba'elef to what we could do in the Megillah. Megillat Esther, every turn and every twist, there's so much to discuss and so much to analyze. And just remember the klal. Every word in Tanakh is a polished gem. Every word there not only has much to teach, but opens up doors to other things to teach and to investigate. There's nothing extra. But everything is a lightning rod for more discussion and more information. I say that almost as an apologia that we're not having a full-day seminar on Megillat Esther. But we'll try to at least get a sense of a panoramic view of the issue of the plot and the role that these first two prakim play in the plot. I'm going to start with a reflection as a teacher in high school. I've been a high school teacher, a yeshiva rabbi, for quite a while now, longer than I spent in high school. And an issue comes up often, which we have an immediate reaction based on so the way that we're sensitized and our roles as both teachers and administrators. But if you look at it from a perspective, a larger perspective perhaps, the answer might not be so simple. A student will ask me, and it's often a student who maybe a friend of his is about to get in the hot seat for doing something wrong. It's always somebody else. Is lying really wrong? And of course, our immediate reaction, of course, because we assume we're talking about cheating on a test, or, and the student will then, who has done his homework, will then raise the specter of story A and story B and story C and story D, and that's just in parts of Bereishit, where people who we regard as role models act with, shall we say, less than full disclosure. There's a very big machlok of Rishonim how to read Yaakov's coming into his father when his father is blind. And most Rishonim do not follow the direction that Rashi adopts in the Midrash about Anochi Mish, Anochi Veisavu Bechorecha. Nobody claims that Avraham really told Paro, yes, she's really my wife, but we'll pretend she's my sister. And of course, the Rishonim are divided on how to evaluate Avraham on that. The students, of course, have done their homework in the areas that they need. They're very good at that. And they'll challenge with that. A teacher of mine, Rav Elchanan Samet, pointed out that deception from the perspective of Tanakh is not an inherently wrong thing to do. It really depends on the circumstances. And this is not moral relativism. Deception is often the only tool that the disenfranchised has to balance the scales. If you think about nothing more than the most storied battle in Tanakh, which is David and Goliath. Read the story carefully and you will see that David twice or three times uses deception. It's not a fair fight. Of course it's a fair fight. This guy's an animal. And David is a kid, by his own admission, by Shaul's claim. So how does David balance the scales? He notes, well, this guy's strength is his strength and his might and his size. But he's not that bright. And he's not that quick. And I'm going to use my strength and I'll use it against his weakness. And indeed, this is, if you look through Sefer Bereishit, the way that those who are less empowered successfully balance the scales. It becomes important because when we look at Megillat Esther, we're looking at a plot, core plot, in which there is one and perhaps two fully empowered enemies threatening the absolute worst thing, and there is one and perhaps two heroes or heroines who are nearly disenfranchised, nearly powerless, who have to find a way to balance the scales and to win. And if you doubt what I'm saying, take a look at Perek Dalet, where Esther responds to Mordechai's demand that she go and plead her case to the king. What is her response? Pasuk Yer Aleph, Kol Avdei HaMelech, Ve'am Medinot HaMelech Yodim, Asher Kol Ish Ve'isha Asher Yavu Al HaMelech, HaLachatzer HaPim V'tasher Lo Yikare Achat Dato LaHamit. Anyone who comes to the king without being summoned, Achat Dato LaHamit, which means they all have the same rule, they die. A peasant who somehow sneaks in, a lower member of the court, a chief minister, or the queen, doesn't matter, it's all the same rule. What's that rule? You come in without being summoned, you die. Now, there is a stinging barb against the Persian court here. You have to pay attention to it. And to understand it, there's an important word that shows up throughout the Megillah, which is introduced into Hebrew through the Megillah. It's a Persian word, and the word is dat. What does the word dat mean? Not da'at, but dat. Or as we would say today, perhaps dos. What is dat? So in modern Hebrew, what is dat? Religion. On your Tudat Zahut, it says dat Yehudi. What does dat mean in medieval Hebrew? When the Rambam uses the word, what does he refer to? The creed or belief system. Dat ha'emet. What does the word dat mean in the Mishnah? Behavior. Famous Mishnah in Ketubot, dat Yehudit. Dat Moshev Yehudit. The custom, the behavior. And indeed, that's much closer to the original meaning. The word dat means protocol in Persian. Very ancient Persian. All the Persians I know in L.A., none of them know what dat means as a Persian word. Oh, good. So Eshtat Lamo is a very big problem with the Kriyam Ktiv and Ashedot. It's a difficult passage. But the word dat, in its original meaning, comes to us through Bayit Sheni parts of Tanakh as a Persian word, which we're familiar with from ancient Farsi. It means protocol. It's a word that shows up about 22 times in the Megillah. Because the Persian court is filled with protocol. Everything's done according to custom. And the rules can't be broken. Unless, of course, they are. Which shows you just how firm the dat is. Look at this pasuk. Anyone who is not summoned to the king will die. Unless the king picks his scepter up, in which case you won't. And you understand how much of a needle that is. You have these hard and firm rules which could mean life or death. And they depend on the mood of a guy. There's a stinging sharp shot there, and we're going to see a shot of that in Perek Aleph in a couple minutes. But you understand that Esther herself is saying, I am as powerless as anyone else in the kingdom. The fact that I'm queen doesn't give me any in. And so how is Esther going to defeat her enemy or enemies? How is Esther going to save her people? She's going to do so by taking her own particular talent and using it against her enemy or enemies. And what we need is we need the first two prakim to get three pieces of information, which are vital for understanding the plot. We have to understand what Esther's particular talent is. We have to understand Ahasuerus's weakness. And believe it or not, parts of Perek Bet and then of course Perek Gimel are going to tell us Haman's weakness. And then we'll understand how Esther uses her strength against their weaknesses to defeat them. Because of course, as we all know, she wins. We're here, they're not. So let's go to the very beginning. Very good place to start. Go to good. Some people have sound of music fans. Perek Aleph. And again, as a student of Tanakh, I am absolutely offended by the beginning of this Megillah. You can't do this, by the way, in regular voice. Listen to the tone of this. Who? Now the old joke goes, it's a hard of hearing thing. Who? Achashverosh. Okay, cute. But the real text is saying, and you get the sense of an extremely huge person, person of great stature. And I'm offended because I'm a student of Tanakh, and I know in Tanakh there's only one Melech. There's only one great. That is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Mat pitom, who is this guy? And it keeps going. And you hear the trumpets in the background, and there's a choir doing this whole thing. It's great. But it's offensive to us. Sheva, and we find very soon that at least from the perspective of the Tanakh, it's a facade. And it's a facade, that it's a facade we read right away in the third pasuk. So in the first two pasukim, we hear about this huge king who rules everything that we know, from the Indus River into North Africa. And by the way, Ahasuerus historically built a land bridge across the Dardanelles and brought his army in and burned the city of Athens. So we're talking about a huge empire. We know the size of the Persian Empire. It's great. Great in the sense of large and very powerful. Again, puffery, pomp, circumstance, you have Elgar going crazy in the background. And by the way, I'm offended again. What does Bira mean? Okay, so if there's guys who just came back from Israel, no, it doesn't mean that. Okay? That's pronounced Bira. That's a different thing. And they are going to raise the age, by the way. Okay? What is Bira? So we all know, Bira is capital. Bira, Nitzchit, Lam Yisrael, Yerushalayim, beautiful. The word Bira does not mean capital in Tanakh. The word Bira means fortress. And there is only one other Bira in Tanakh. If you have a Tanakh in front of you and you want to open up, or later on take a look, Divrei Hayamim Aleph Perek Chavtet Pasuk Aleph, you will see that David refers to the Mikdash as a Bira. Ki lo la adam habira livnot, ki im lashem. Bira is the fortress of the Mikdash. Now having that knowledge and then reading this, I'm absolutely offended. Shushan habira, hamelech Achashverosh. What's wrong with you guys? And I'm hearing about the king sitting on his throne, meaning taking his position, kishavet, as he ascends the throne. And I'm about to hear about a lavish party, which is evidently a overblown coronation party. And there's a couple words at the beginning of Pasuk Gimel that already show me what a facade it is. B'shnat shalosh l'molcho asa mishtel l'chol sarav v'avadav. Oops. See the problem? This great king who's so powerful is making a coronation party in the third year. I'm not going party lines here, but even George Bush, who won the election by a scant 9 votes, was still able to put his inaugural ball together in a couple weeks. Why does it take this guy 3 years to have a coronation? What's wrong? And what kind of coronation is it? The whole Sarav Avadav. Who does he have at this party? Now remember, it's 127 provinces, and it's called Sarav Avadav, which means he's got Chel Parasum Adai, all of the officers, the military machine. Hapartamim means the guys with names on plaques. That's actually not a literal translation. It means the financial backers, the machers. The Sarei Hamdinot, the Fanav. So which three groups does he have in front of him? He has the military machine, the financial machine, and the political machine. In other words, all the people who are important for his rule. From all over the kingdom. And we get a lavish description, which I really don't need. I think I don't need. Of the party. And I'm told that this party lasts 6 months. Now, when you think of a party lasting for 6 months, you get nauseous right away, and you're not even thinking about the bill. By the way, the bill is not his. The bill is the taxpayers. Important to note that. And Achashverosh is having this lavish party for the people who matter most. And Chazal point out that at the end, he does something very smart. It's Machlok at Rabban Shmuel, if it's smart or not smart. But who does he invite for the last 7 days of the party? After the 6 months? Everybody in Shushan. Why everybody in Shushan? So what was the purpose of the entire party? The purpose of the entire party was to consolidate his power and make sure that all of the military machine, all of the financial backers, and all of the politicos were on his side. Were loyal to him, liked him, respected him, and more importantly, feared him. And that's why he has this party. And again, I have to ask the question, why do I need to know about this? I'm not interested in the history of the Persian Empire. Truth is, I am, but not from here. That's not what the Tanakh is here for. So why am I being informed about all this? We'll find out. And then at the end, he has a 7-day party for everybody from Shushan. By the way, Andrew Jackson must have read this. You guys remember when he opened up the White House one day to all the Hicks and the farmers, and they're still cleaning it up. That's what he did. He had a party for everybody in Shushan. The Migadol, the Ad Katan. That's not a basketball term. That's a status term. Important people all the way down to the lowly people. They all came in. Why did he have everybody in Shushan? So Chazal say, in case there's an insurrection, at least he has the last line of defense to protect him. Shit, Chazal is telling us, why is Ahasuerus having this whole party? Because he's afraid of an insurrection. He's afraid of rebellion. He's afraid that his rule will not take. And now we understand why it took him 3 years to have a coronation. You read a little bit about the history of the Persian Empire, you find out that the last guy who took over, who was a very successful emperor, his name was Dariavish. In the year 520 BCE or 521 BCE, I'm using, by the way, the non-art scroll version of history, sorry. Took him 2 years until he could consolidate his position as emperor. It was a 2-year fight for succession. Ahasuerus has the same problem. And Ahasuerus certainly has what to worry about, that in this far-flung kingdom, there's going to be rebellion. And it was a problem, as we notice at the end of Perek Bet, that there's two of his own food tasters, or wine tasters, in his palace trying to poison him. Shomrei HaSaf, the ones who guard the cup. Big Tam Materesh, try to poison him. So he's got these problems. And that's why it takes him a couple years to have the party. And now we understand the story of Vashti much better. So let's skip ahead to Vashti. Perek Aleph Pasuk Tet. He's got this whole party. And on the very last day of the party, he's going to summon Vashti. We hear that Vashti, the old joke goes, how do we know Vashti was very fat? And he saved this for porn. Gan Vashti amaka astam mishtei nashim. Okay, cute. Right. But the reality, of course, is that she was evidently drop-dead gorgeous. She also made a party for the women. Which women, by the way? Critical to know. Which women? This is part of the story. Which women were at Vashti's party? Who do you think? The wives of. Why weren't the wives of at the party? Why weren't they at Ahasuerus' party? Because Ahasuerus' party was a networking party. I've got 40,000 extra soldiers. I don't know what to do with them. I just had an insurrection. Here's how I put it down. Ooh, that's a good idea. It's a networking party. It's a political gathering. No, there was feasting, of course. And there may have been all sorts of bacchanal there also. But the women are having their own party because they're not part of that. Now, they are at Vashti's party. What happens? Bayom HaShvi'i Ketov Lev HaMelech Bayayin. Now, important to note, the pictures that we all got as little kids. I mean, some of us, they had just figured out how to make pictures when we were little kids, but we have pictures of Ahasuerus looking like Mary King, what's his name? Old King Cole. You know, big, fat, jolly, kind of tipsy, drunk all the time. Important to note, within the Megillah itself, nobody ever gets drunk. Oh, some of us may get drunk in response. But in the Megillah itself, nobody gets drunk. What does Tov Lev HaMelech Bayayin mean? How would you translate that? Ketov Lev HaMelech Bayayin. What does that mean? He's feeling good. He's feeling good. Got a little buzz on. It's okay. By the way, Liyot Tov Lev Bayayin is not a bad thing. One of the most heroic characters in all of Tanakh, at the moment of his greatest heroism, is described that way. And that is Boaz, in Perek Gimel of Rut. It's not a bad thing. Shikor, that's a bad thing. That's Naval. What does he do? He summons 7 of his sarisim. Just to clarify something about language here. What is a saris? A eunuch. Saris is a eunuch, and we know that the verb lasares is to castrate. And we know we're familiar with the word saris throughout the Mishnayot and Yevamot, modern Hebrew. And okay, good. So what does saris mean, though, originally? The word saris actually comes from a Sumerian word which means shalrosh. And a saris was really somebody who served the king. Now, because many of the sarisim were people who also served the queen or the harem, therefore they had to make sure that there wouldn't be any problems. And thus the word saris ended up meaning the way that we use it already in Mishnaic terms. But many of the sarisim that we meet here are not necessarily incomplete. I have to say it delicately. Here it's unclear, although these sarisim are described as hamashartim et pnei ha-melech Hashirosh. By the way, that's an important thing to know also. We know from the customs of the Persian Empire that the emperor was somebody who was rarely seen by anybody. You know, we got a picture. I grew up with a picture of Ahasuerus sitting at the party, l'chaim to everybody, and everybody come up, how you doing? Nobody saw Ahasuerus. He was behind a curtain, probably in a private chamber. And there were only a few people who were all called ro'ei pnei ha-melech, or mesharte pnei ha-melech. Those are the people who actually saw the king. He's not a public figure in that sense. But these are seven of his closest advisors who serve him. What does he tell them? And we got to read their names. And for us, Balei Kriya, that's a little bit of a challenge. Muhumman Bistai. When we're trying to go at 16-minute pace in the morning, it's not so easy. Lahavid Vashtiya Malkal Lifnei HaMelech Becheter Malchut. Pshutoso Mikra. What is Ahasuerus demanding? Pshutoso Mikra. What is he demanding? I'm familiar with the Midrashim, and the Midrashim have a very deep point. Very, very deep and profound point. But Pshutoso Mikra, what is Ahasuerus demanding? That Vashti come out in all of her finery. Laharot amim vasarim et yofya ki tovat marehi. Why does he want to do this? Why does he want to show her off? So the text tells you, because look back at Pasuk Dalet. What is the purpose of the entire party? The first word in Pasuk Dalet tells you. Vaharoto, he's showing off all of his splendor and all of his glory and all of his wealth that he got on the backs of the taxpayers, but all of his wealth. Jewel-inlaid floors and gold beds. And so what's the creme de la creme? What's the cherry on top? Vashti. Most beautiful woman in the kingdom. He wants her to come out so he can show off his trophy wife. What's Vashti's response? Vatma'e. Why? So we have lots of Midrashim trying to explain her behavior because the Midrashim contend that she was also interested in coming out. But right now I'm not concerned with why. I'm concerned with what. What is it that she did? Vatma'en ha-malkah vashti lavo bidvar ha-melech. And then the text adds three words that I don't need, which is asher biyad ha-sarisin. What is it that Vashti did? She refused to come at the beck and call of the king, delivered through these messengers. So now let's get a picture. Something that I've written about in the first volume. I have a second volume hopefully coming out later this year. I think the first volume is available in this farm sale. Between the lines of the Bible. You cannot properly understand narrative unless you put yourself into the narrative. You got to picture what's going on. So we got a picture. Here's Vashti's party. All the women are there. The wives of, and that's critical. And in the middle of this party, whatever they're doing, they're crocheting, there's a cake in the middle of the room, I don't care. Not my problem. But what I do know is that seven ministers of the king walk into the party, what probably happens at that point? Dead silence. They don't do this. There's a tweet to Vashti, or maybe a BlackBerry message. I'm sure she had a BlackBerry. They don't send a BBM to Vashti saying, please come with your royal finery. They come in and publicly, hear ye, by order of, and it's not by order of Ahasuerus, by order of the defender of the realm, protector of the king of kings, right? Maybe they'll say his name. Vashti, the queen, is hereby summoned to come, in front of everybody. And what does Vashti say? No. By the way, Vashti, in a turnaround on the old joke, doesn't have much of a talking role in the play. He says one word. No. That's it. What is the impact of that, of those two letters? What is the impact of her no? The impact is not a private impact between Ahasuerus and Vashti. The impact is a very public impact that hurts Achashverosh and the entire enterprise he's been involved with from day one of these 6 months and 7 days. Because his goal is to impress, to gain the respect of, to gain the fear of and the loyalty of all of the important members of his court. And now what has happened to him publicly? He's not only been humiliated, he's been humiliated by his wife. And we read in the rest of Perek Aleph why that's such a crucial thing. So what is Achashverosh's reaction to this dismissive behavior? He does what every good king does. He gets angry and he calls a meeting. Must have worked for some Jewish organization, I'm sure. He gets very angry and he calls a meeting. And what does he do at the meeting? Who does he summon? L'chachamim yodei ha'itim. Who are yodei ha'itim? Pshat, yodei ha'itim. What does that mean?
Astrologers.
Maybe. But there's a simpler explanation to yodei ha'itim. Just translate the words. What does it mean? Translate the words. People who know the times. They're not watchmakers.
Advisors.
Which advisors? His historians. What's he asking them? Kedat ma'ala asot. What's the protocol? Check the books. What happened last time that a Persian queen dissed her the emperor? And they come back with this. You guys know what this is, right? Loser. It never happened before. We got to make up new law. And as Chazal point out, the advisors are between a rock and a hard place. Actually, geographically, they're between Iraq and a hard place. Save that one for each year. They're in an impossible situation. As Chazal point out, because if they turn around and say, off with their head, divashtiizer, a day, 2 days, 4 days later, the king calms down, and you'll suddenly find yourself sitting next to your own head. If, on the other hand, they say, forgive her, let her go, it could create a real problem in the kingdom. So we now meet a second character who is an absolutely secondary, tertiary, side character in the plot, and Chazal turn him into a central character, and they do so with tremendous, tremendous depth. Vayomer Memuchan. What do Chazal say about Memuchan? Haman. Kshitoso mikra Memuchan is not Haman. Because the Tanakh knows how to call Haman Haman and how to call Memuchan Memuchan. We have numerous places where Chazal identified disparate characters as being the same person. Hu Daryavesh, Hu Artachshasta, Hu Koresh, the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, as an example. And so some of the Rishonim take a look at that statement, for instance, and say, wait a second, we know that these are different characters. How can you possibly say they're the same person? And so the mainstream explanation of that statement is that even though they appear from the psukim to have a different attitude towards Klal Yisrael, you should understand that inside there's really one approach. Hu Memuchan Hu Haman, or Memuchan Ze Haman, I think what Chazal are pointing out is if you want to understand Haman, take a look at Memuchan. They share an important trait. And it's something we're never told about in Haman's case, and a question arises when we read the Haman story, which we're going to get to very quickly. But if you read the Memuchan story, you can figure it out. Memuchan is a brilliant guy. He's an advisor. And again, the advisors are caught in a very difficult quandary. How does he pull himself out of the quandary? How does he become a hero to Achashverosh? Because he is. He reasons as follows. Let me give you an example. Again, I apologize, but I'm a high school teacher. Nothing to apologize for, but hopefully some of you could take yourselves back a few years and you'll appreciate the impact of this. I teach seniors, which means I usually get the second semester off. So you remember, good. I teach seniors. I talk to my seniors and I say, okay, you're on the basketball court. Basketball, of course, is the second religion in Yeshiva High School. You're on the basketball court. And a little freshman comes up, takes the ball away from you, and dribbles off with it and starts his own little 3-on-3. What do you do? So the ones who are honest say, well, you know, I want to punch his lights out. But on the other hand, I feel like, you know, he's 3'5", and I'm 6 feet tall. He weighs about 30 pounds, and I weigh more. And I'm going to feel like an idiot punching him out. Yeah, but you want him. Okay. Let's say I'm your buddy and I want to get you to punch his lights out. How will I say it? So if I say, punch his lights out, he says, no, I'm above that. But if I say to him, he has disgraced the entire senior class. The honor of the senior class rests in your hands and in your fists. Not only the senior class, but the traditions of our revered high school and yeshiva rest on your defending the honor. Suddenly, I'm a noble guy. I'm going to go punch his lights out and feel like a hero. What does Memuchan say to Achashverosh? Lo ha-melech levado avta Vashti ha-malka. Vashti has not just disgraced you, she's disgraced all of the men. You have the honor of all of the men of the kingdom in your hands. You've got to do something about it. Now Achashverosh can act lashing out and yet feel good about it. And by the way, here's the scenario. And that's why I pointed out that it's the wives of, critical. The governor of Upper Southwest Luzerstan, one of the far-flung provinces of the Persian Empire, comes to pick up his wife at the end of the party. And they're going off. They go back home to Upper Southwest Luzerstan. They get home. He's tired. He says, get me a beer. And her response is, get your own beer. He says, wife, get me a beer. So get your own beer. So are you crazy? She goes, listen, Vashti didn't come to the king. Why should I come to you? Great. And now everything the king has worked for 6 months and 7 days is going to be destroyed by two letters, N-O, that his wife uttered. Because it was public. And now the king has to act to defend the honor of all the men in the kingdom so that he can keep their loyalty. This very long picture that I've drawn for you, which is Perek Aleph, is a picture of a king whose throne doesn't sit so easy and so stable. He's a king who's got lots of reasons to be paranoid. And remember, it's not neurotic to be paranoid if they're really out to get you. Think about it. And that's what his circumstance is. So that's piece one. I'll go very quickly through piece two, which is Perek Bet, which is Esther. And again, all of the descriptions of the primping and the oils and everything else, what I need it for. So you notice something interesting happens. At Perek Bet, Pasuk Tet, we find that Esther immediately gains the favor of the guy, who, by the way, has a very unfortunate name. His name is Haggai, but he's definitely a real Saris. Maybe the hay means half, I don't know. And this fellow, as it were, is in charge of all of the girls. Somehow Esther becomes his favorite. We don't know how. We're going to find out. We don't know how. But as a result of that, he gives her the best oils and the best treatment and the best seven girls to serve her, et cetera, et cetera. He's going to really favor her. We don't know why. We're going to find out. And so, psukim that to us sound not only trivial, but kind of vile. Hearing about a girl, and by the way, these girls, how old are these girls? How old are these girls? They're 12. If you're that good looking and you're 14 in the Persian Empire, you're not single anymore. Nobody gets married at 15, 16, 17 in the ancient world. Girls got married at the age of 12. Unless they were really hideous or came from totally impoverished families or in some way couldn't marry. So we're talking about 12-year-old girls, 11, 12-year-old girls here. It's important to understand that in the plot. What do we hear about these girls? Take a look at Pasuk Yobet. Uvagia, Tor, Na'arav, Na'arav, Avol, Na'achash, Rosh, Mikesa, Yod, La, blah, 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 all of this. 6 months of this oil and 6 months of that oil and the depilatories. Uvazen Rabal Hamelech. This is the critical piece. It kolasher tomar yinatin la lavoima mi beit anashima beit hamelech. And by the way, you should understand, it wasn't that you get to try out to be queen and if it doesn't work, you go home and go back to high school. There's no high school. There's no adolescence. There isn't even NCSY. There's nothing to go back to. If you don't make it, you go to the harem forever. This is not a win-win. This might be a win-lose, it might be a lose-lose. But this is a real risk. What does the girl take with her for her night with the king? What does she wear? What perfumes does she put on? What kind of wine does she bring in? Does she have four? Does she have a string quartet walking in playing as time goes by? What does she do? Kol asher tomar yinaten la, vavoima. Whatever she wants, whatever she requests, that's what she brings in. Now, you're Haggai. A person is Haggai. Oh, curse anybody here. A person is Haggai. This is somebody who's been working with these girls for a while. He knows what the king likes. This little 11, 12-year-old tzutzik walks in and says, I want the green shirt. My uncle Albert says, I always look good in green. And the guy says, listen, sweetie, the king hates green. I don't care. I want green. We all know what girls who have been told since day one that they are the most beautiful girl in the world can sometimes be like. Hey, call. Share tomorrow, you're not in love. And so they go in and then they end up with shashgaz for the rest of their life. Now read the critical pazuk. Uvagia, and the Tamami car is so beautiful here. Uvagia, Tor Esther, Batavichai, Eldod Mordechai. We hear such a buildup. This is an absolutely critical pasuk. What is it that Esther requests?
Nothing.
Whatever Haggai says. Haggai, you're the expert. What does the king like? This kind of dress, that kind of dress. This kind of wine, that kind of wine. Should I come in early? Should I come in a little late? Build up the suspense. What should I do? You're the boss. Now, if somebody is Haggai, how is Haggai going to feel about this girl who, among all the other girls, comes to him and says, you know better than I do? How does any one of us in this room feel, certainly those of us who are already in the working world, feel when somebody calls us, a neighbor, a friend, a member of our shul, calls us for a quick piece of advice about something that we know about? We feel great. We feel worthwhile. We have something to contribute. How do you think Haggai feels about this one girl who says to him, I don't know what the king, you're the expert, you tell me what to wear. Do you understand why Haggai favors her? Do you understand why Haggai schedules her for a night in Tevet? What does Chazal say about Tevet? Long, cold nights. What a great time to win the king over. I'll bet that the girl who said, I want the green chiffon, got July 4th. So we understand now a very important thing. Esther, as young as she is, already understands something critically about the human psyche. You need to understand how the other person thinks. First of all, you need to know where the power is. And right now, in this situation, Haggai has the power. Second of all, you have to know how to think as the person in power thinks, and then appeal to what they need or play on what they think. We quickly go to the third character in this drama, which of course is Haman. Now when Chazal say Mimuchan ze Haman, they're telling us something very deep. Mimuchan was smart enough to take the king and get the king to do what he wanted and make the king feel good about it. Which of course answers a very large question, because when we meet Haman, we hear something that is preposterous. Haman gets the king to dictate an order that every member of the court should bow to Haman. Do you realize how ridiculous that is? How self-destructive that is to Ahasuerus, especially after what we've heard? This is a king whose rule is not so secure, who's got people in his own court trying to poison him, and yet he orders all the members of his court to bow to one of his ministers? Tells us that Haman is pretty good at doing the wrap around the finger thing. He must have found some way to tell Ahasuerus, listen, Ahasuerus, you never leave the palace, nobody ever sees you, nobody ever gets a chance to bow to you. I'm your chief minister, they'll bow to me, it'll be like bowing to you, they'll be following your orders, etc., etc. And somehow Haman gets Ahasuerus to do something which is preposterous. But we now find out about Haman's weakness. Take a look at the critical passage about Haman. Perek Gimel. By the way, if you read Perek Gimel carefully, you will see that Haman did not notice Mordechai not bowing down. Take a look. Pasuk bet. V'chol adei ha-melech asher v'shar ha-melech koreim ishtachavim l'haman ki chen tziva lo ha-melech u'morachai lo yichrav v'lo yishtachaveh. That raises a whole other question about why not. V'emru avdei ha-melech asher v'shar ha-melech l'morachai madu ata over et mitzvat ha-melech. So they asked him. V'hi ki omra melav yom v'yom, which brings us, of course, back to the Yosef and Potiphar story. That's a whole parsha by itself. What happened? All the members of the court ran to Haman and said, Mordechai is not bowing. Now, this could be perceived as the guys on the court. This never happens, Baruch Hashem, seriously, it never happens in our school. But I know that in public schools this sort of thing happens, where two guys will start hurting each other and suddenly they'll go, fight, fight, and all things. And these two guys who just want nothing more than to push each other suddenly end up hurting each other. It sounds like that's what the servants are doing, the court members of the court are doing. Hey, Haman, guess he's up there and down here. Let's see who wins. It could be that they're actually trying to take Haman down. They don't have the guts to do it. Two ways to read it. But either way, Haman doesn't notice him. Now watch what happens. Vayar Haman. Now he notices. Now why didn't he notice? Maybe he's riding in a sedan with a curtain. Maybe Mordechai, every time that Haman comes by, has to sneeze. Maybe he goes behind a corner. I don't know. But now Haman takes notice. Ki eng Mordechai koreo mishtachavelo. Vayimalei Haman chema. Haman blows up because one little court Jew doesn't bow down to him. One little guy. And he gets so angry that he's not willing to take Mordechai down. He wants to take all of Mordechai's people down. This guy's nuts. This guy's neurotic. And the worst part of it comes in Perek Hey. There's a pasuk which I contend represents the most pathetic statement in all of Tanakh. Take a look at Perek Hey in pasuk. We'll start with pasuk Yod Aleph. Haman leaves the first party where he's been invited as the honored guest of Esther and Achashverosh, and he leaves this party full of himself. And he walks outside, and there is Mordechai. I'm sure that he's whistling the Himnon HaPalmach. I just picture him. And Haman walks past. He doesn't bow down, and Haman blows up. Somehow Haman holds it in, comes home, and he blows up. What does he do? He assembles all of his family. Think how pathetic this is. He calls his family together and tells them how great he is. Look how much wealth I have. Look how many kids I have. And I'm the greatest minister. I'd love to be a fly on that wall, just for 5 minutes. Not only that, but I am the only guest invited to this private party with Esther and Achashverosh, and tomorrow I'm invited again. And then, listen to this statement. How pathetic it is. V'chol zeh einenu shoveh li. None of this is worth anything to me. I can't stand seeing Mordechai standing there. None of this is worth anything to me. I don't know the politics here. I mean, Republican, Democrat politics, everything. I don't know what anybody here thinks of Richard Nixon, but there's a story about Richard Nixon. It may not even be true, but it's a great story. Richard Nixon, as you know, in 1962, walked out of politics with, you won't have Dick Nixon to kick around anymore. 6 years later, he became president of the United States. Quite a kick. 4 years later, in 1972, he was elected by what was at the time the greatest popular vote landslide in history. Reagan Mondale was bigger. But at the time, it was the greatest one in history. And if you recall, our troops were still in Southeast Asia. And in after the election, he was sitting in the White House, and across the street in Lafayette Park, there was a protest going on, hell no, we won't go, get out of Cambodia, Laos, etc. And one person had a sign, down with Nixon. And supposedly Nixon lost it. Now I want you to imagine, this is somebody who was kicked out of politics, kicked himself out of politics. And now 10 years later, he has been reelected by the greatest popular vote in history. All right, McGovern, but still, greatest popular vote in history. And one guy has a sign and he can't stand it. Whether the story is true or not is irrelevant. It sort of fits the model of what we know about Nixon. It doesn't matter, because that's Haman. Haman is a nobody who out of nowhere has been elevated to the position of the grand minister of the empire in the world, controls everything, and even has a plot to kill his enemy and all of his enemy's people 11 months from now. And this one guy won't bow down to him and he can't stand it. And he says, nothing is worth anything to me. And by the way, that's of course his downfall, because what happens? He can't wait 11 months. He's got what we have in school, we call it impulse control issues. He can't really wait 11 months to see his enemy die. He's got to go now. So his family gives him advice to run to the palace that night and ask the king to impale Mordechai in the morning, and then he'll come to the party being happy. That of course is his downfall, because this is why HaKadosh Baruch Hu loves to just put these people together. Haman comes running into the palace in the middle of the night while the king is trying to figure out. Now let's see why the king is trying to figure this out. So we'll put Esther's plot together right now, and in 5 minutes it'll all come together. What do we now know about Haman? Haman has absolutely no sense of self. Every bit of information he gets about himself, he gets from other people. And if anybody out there says you're not worth bowing down to, it destroys him. He is what we call an egotist, but it's really somebody with no ego, no sense of self. Now, we've got the picture. We know who Achashverosh is. We'll call him paranoid. We know who Haman is. Haman is an egotist. We know what Esther is. She is bright. She understands how to take other people's weaknesses or needs and play on them. So what does she do? What's her plot? You all know the story, so I'll just walk it outside of the text. Esther comes into the king knowing full well that if you come to the king without being summoned, you could die. The king knows that. So the king, when he sees Esther come in unsummoned, and he hasn't seen her for 30 days, must be wondering, this must be something really important she's risking her life for. He recognizes her, and he expects her to say, I want another palace, I want these enemies killed. What does she say? If you really like me, yeah. If you really like me, yeah. If I find... okay, get to it already. Please come to a party. I want you to picture doing it like this. Please come to a party tonight that I prepared. Bring Haman. You're the king, you got to wonder. I haven't been paying attention to her. 30 days I haven't seen her. She risked her life to invite me to a party and invite Haman, who I just gave a lot of power to. What's going on? So he immediately rushes Haman. Haman, of course, feels great. They come to the party. What happens? King comes up to Esther and says, Esther, what do you want? Half the kingdom, I'll give it to you. If you really like me, yeah. If I found fit, yeah, okay. Come to another party tomorrow. And bring Haman. You got to figure, if you're the king, and remember, paranoid's not a bad idea in your situation. I got to wonder, maybe I was standing too far from the curtain so the guy with the thing couldn't choke me. Maybe they couldn't get the hemlock in on time. Why do they want me at another party? And why is Haman here? Must be maybe the two of them are cooking something up. Do you understand why the king can't sleep? So Chazal said, of course he can't sleep. I have troubles on the outside. I have the troubles of Oyelim Mibray, Oyelim Mikvay. Goran Megillah. I got troubles on the outside. I got troubles on the inside. And so what's he looking for? He's looking for one loyal member of his court. He has them read the annals. Who does he find out is a loyal member of his court? Mordechai. And then he says, okay, how has Mordechai been honored? What's the answer? It's been 4 years. Nothing yet. Oops. 5 years. Nothing yet. All right? He realizes, I've got to throw Mordechai a big party and announce that this party is in honor of the fact that he revealed a plot. And then maybe somebody will come and tell me about what Esther and Haman are cooking up. Great. So he's planning, how should I honor Mordechai? And just at that moment, oh, it's great. Vayavo Haman! It's a great moment. And you're just watching it, and you're laughing. Because Haman's walking in saying, well, actually, if you think about it, Haman and Achashverosh want the same thing. They'd like to elevate Mordechai. Of course. There's a little nafka mina between this elevation and that, but small things. So Haman comes in, and of course the king, being the 800-pound gorilla, gets to ask first. He says, okay, what should I do for... Now notice, the king is no dummy. He's very sharp. He thinks Haman is after his throne, so what does he say? What should I do for somebody I really want to honor, knowing that Haman's going to think it's him? And Haman thinks it's him. He falls for it. So what does Haman describe? What does he describe, really? A coronation. Haman gives away his hand. The king's horse with the king's crown on it, and the king's finery, and a slave walking in front of him, one of the mockers walking in front of him, declaring... And you could see the whole thing just go crazy on him when the king turns out and says, good idea, do it for Mordechai. Ha Yehudi, Ha Yishev, Yishar, Melech. Chazal build it up greatly. The king says to Haman, do it for Mordechai. There's a lot of Mordechais. There's a lot of Mordechais among the Yehudim. The one who sits at the king. Oh, okay. And from then on, it all falls. How did Esther do this? Esther simply played a paranoid guy against an egotist. How do you defeat a paranoid person? Give him something to worry about. How do you defeat an egotist? Build him up. An egotist is like a balloon. The bigger you blow him up, the more he gets stretched thin. And then the smallest little thorn from a rose bush will punch him. She builds Haman up so big, he walks outside of the palace, there's Mordechai, he loses it. And in the meantime, she's given Ahasuerus lots to worry about. The crowning moment, of course, comes, sorry for the pun, when Haman comes to plead his case, and this is where Chazal have the malach, with the quick foot. Haman comes to plead his case to Esther while Ahasuerus is taking a walk, and Haman ends up on top of her in bed. Everything the king has feared is right in front of him. Everything. The two of them are plotting. They're going to kill me. They're going to marry each other. They're going to take over the kingdom. And immediately, Haman is gone. We need the first two prakim because we need to see who Ahasuerus is and we need to see who Esther is. And we need the little bit about Memuchan to understand Haman's abilities. And we need Perek Gimel, besides the plot itself, to tell us what Haman's weakness is. And then we understand how Esther, B'siyata D'Shmaya, was able to put all of this together as a relatively young girl of about 17 or 18 at this time in order to defeat her enemies by pushing them against each other. And Baruch Hashem, we're still here. Thank you.